This is Poured Over, a show about stories presented by the booksellers of Barnes & Noble. So here we go. I'm Miwa Messer. I'm the producer and host of Poured Over. And remember Olga Dies Dreaming? Remember that amazing, amazing voicey novel that made all of us stop in our tracks? Of course you do, because Xochitl Gonzalez is awesome. And there's the new novel, Anita de Monte. More importantly, though, I want to talk about the evolution of this book, because I learned some stuff prepping for the show that I did not know about the creation of the new novel.
Oh.
So we've got to go back to Brown for a second.
Okay.
In the 90s, when no one has cell phones and we're all barbarians.
Yeah, barbarians. Literally. Yeah.
Oh. We were all barbarians in
the
90s.
I know. And we left. Remember, we DM'd by leaving whiteboard messages on each other's dorm room doors.
Yes, we did.
Yeah.
We were very lo-fi. Super lo-fi. But we have to go back to Brown.
Yeah.
It all starts there. So tell us a story.
I mean, I was like a major art history nerd.
Mm-hmm.
I just loved it and was like completely obsessed. Mm-hmm. And I took all, I basically exploited the open curriculum to become an amateur art historian. Like, I just took every art history class. And for people who don't know, the open curriculum just means that Brown has no requirements. So, like, and that was what made me pick it, because okay. I, in a pre-STEM world, was like, I hate math and I don't care. And I'm going to avoid it for as much as I possibly can, including the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And now that's why my accountant hates me. But I basically was like, I love this. I fell in love with it and I did art history and visual art. And I lived in this one building that's now super old. Like literally, I think it's like a, you know, sort of like a has-been on this campus that's been so renovated. But I just stayed in this little building on the RISD side of campus, because Brown is right near this art school named RISD. And then on the weekends, my friend hosted this radio show, because the Brown radio station, like 6 days a week, was like an alternative rock pop station. And then on the seventh day, they played like all hip-hop and R&B and then jazz and gospel and all, like, it was called the 360-degree Black Experience in Sound. And my best guy friend, mm-hmm. was like their star DJ. And I would go and I'd help him pick the new records and we'd all hang out at the station. So Sunday was like my kind of back to the planet day. And then the rest of the week, I just was sort of like by myself a lot, like mm-hmm. in this little art history world, like really where none of my friends were. It was a really segregated time, not just at Brown, I think in higher ed in general, because it was sort of like the wave where there was enough critical mass from affirmative action mm-hmm. that there was a community, but it was a super small community. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, it was like we had like admissions, but then no real serious financial aid. So like everybody was like working like 17 jobs and like, you know, like it was like really a funny, funky time. And so there was kind of the regular Brown, and then there was sort of like the tiny subworld of like minority students at Brown.
And culture shock. A lot of culture shock.
So much culture shock that I didn't actually figure out one big part of it until I was writing this book.
Okay.
I mean, like that, that's probably, I could say, happened with me and my mother in the first book. Like, I'm like, I didn't figure that out until I was writing this book. But with this, I didn't really figure out what the root of the culture shock was mm-hmm. as much as I did when I was writing this. And it was like, it wasn't just that I was at this giant public school, like New York City public school, and like living with my grandparents. I'm friends, you know, some people from like junior high on.
Right.
And then suddenly I'm doing something new and I'm in a new, like, you know, WASPier culture. It's that nobody from home understood the WASPier culture
mm-hmm.
and this new like kind of social code. So then you kind of can't explain what's happening.
Right.
So all of your home base, like sometimes I go back to Brown like a lot, right? Like, and I'll hear kids like crossing campus and they're like on the phone with their parents on their cell phones now, being like, well, what do you think? Should I take this chem class? Should I drop it? Like, you know, like they're like getting all this like real time advice mm-hmm. from their parents that fully understand what's happening there. And that just was not available.
Right.
Like, parenting was different then, period. But like, it was definitely like, I wasn't even going to bring it up. Like, if I was struggling in a class, that was like a problem. So I wasn't even going to bring it up. So I think that part of the culture shock was also that you didn't have a ton of your old support system mm-hmm. sort of just kind of got like, whoop, like off to the side. But I honestly, until I was writing Raquel's family, I didn't completely put that together for myself.
And this is where I'm going to jump in and say, this book is not autofiction.
No.
Olga was not autofiction. Anita DeMonte is not autofiction. No. And there are some people who are going to assume that.
Totally.
And
yeah.
No, you can grab details from your life and you can turn them into art, which is what you do. But really, not autofiction. Can we just like be super clear, not autofiction?
Oh, I think I had to go to a high school class about Olga, and they were like, well, we've decided as a class this is autofiction. And I was like, and you are wrong.
Like, you're adorable, but no, you're children.
You're adorable, but you are wrong. Like, no, I mean, and I think I didn't even intend for us to, I wanted her to have a pretty different, and she does have a different personality than I had. Like, I was like, I was actually literally my senior class president. Like, I don't think I could see Raquel. Like I see Raquel rolling her eyes at that. Like, she's like, I'll never do that. Like, you know, like, and I think she's more reserved. But we had a lot. We had more in common than I'd intended, which then made me realize some things were just universal, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because I didn't go to Brown when you went to Brown. And I think all of us have bad boyfriends in our backstory.
Oh, God, right, yes.
I am not the only one. I don't want to get too far afield, though. I want to go back to the start of this book.
Yeah.
Because like I said, you had more of this book than I knew you did earlier than you did.
Yeah.
And there was some stuff that had happened with Olga. Olga hit the bestseller list.
Yes.
You were talking to Hulu. Stuff was going weirdly with Hulu.
Yeah.
And in fact, you shot the pilot for Olga, and then they said, thank you, no.
Literally, like, the day after the bestseller list came out. Like, okay. So it keeps you humble.
But you'd been working on this book while all of that was happening, right?
So I came up with the idea for this book while that was happening.
Okay.
And then I didn't get to work on it for, like, I started to work on it right after that. Like, I came up with the idea for this book, like, the summer of 2020. Mm-hmm. And I was revising Olga because, like, Olga kind of sat around for a little bit before, like, it was pandemic-y. So, like, you know, we took a longer time with that process of getting it to market. Like, I think it sold in 2020 in January and then, like, it pubbed in January of 22.
Right. And you and I met for the first time in probably in
early December. Of 21, 20. Right? Like, before the...
Wait, you pubbed in 22?
Oh, no, 20...
You pubbed in 21.
That's right.
Right, okay.
Oh, gosh. Sorry. Yeah. No. Jeez. no, and so I think what ended up happening was, like, while I was doing that, I'd already done the rights for Olga, the series, and I'd already started... I worked on the script. And I was getting notes on the script. And the process, you know, I think making television, like, honestly, like, if there's a show you love, it's a miracle. Like, right? Like, it's, like, literally a miracle that it exists. But then if it's a show that you love and it is driven by a BIPOC cast, then it's, like, a double miracle. Like, I don't know, a triple miracle. Like, it's just so difficult. And you're constantly meeting up with, like, things that are just not understood. You know, like, it's, like, it's literally, like, you're trying to... present a world that, like, is completely unknown, but then it's not sci-fi, so you can't actually... Like, I think actually you might have an easier time with sci-fi because you're just like, that's just how the dragons are. Like, you know, like, it's like, and I think, like, it's like, I'm like, I don't know how to tell you this. This is how Puerto Ricans are. Like, you know, like, but it's like, then you seem defensive. So I, so anyway, I had, like, a notes call, and we hung up, and my producing partner texted me, and he's like, what can you do? Art and commerce. And that was, like, the title of a like a close proximity of a title of a textbook that I had in college. And all of a sudden I like took like an angry walk to try to calm down from this annoying notes call. And I was thinking about that art history class. And I was thinking about like how I took so many art history classes, and mainly it wasn't even just like white people. It was like white guys. Like it was like so retro. Like it was just like, I think we got like, you know, the Berth Morisot. And we got, like, oh, my gosh, the woman that does all the vulva calla lilies and things.
George O'Keefe.
Thank you. And that was it. And then it was, like, men. So many men. And, like, and so I remembered encountering the artist Ana Mendieta, like, my senior year-ish, because somebody had given me a book about Caribbean art. And then I was, like, just, I was blown away. I feel dumb thinking about it, but I'm thinking this happens to a lot of people. Like, it's, like, you're just, like, wait a second, there's Caribbean art? Like, but it's like, I was such a good student that I just presumed that I was being taught everything important.
Right.
And it didn't occur to me that there were unimportant things that I wasn't learning. And so when I figured this out, like, I remember I said to one of my, what I was telling one of my art teachers, I was like, I can't believe, one of my art teachers, not an art history teacher, I was like, I can't believe we don't learn any of this. And she was like, you need to look up Ana Mendieta. And then I became fascinated. Right. And so then you fast forward a few years, I mean, 20 years later-ish, and I'm a graduate student in Iowa, which is where Ana Mendieta had been sent after mm-hmm. she left Cuba, and like where she did her MFA. Mm-hmm. And I can't stop thinking about her. And so I'm like walking around fuming about this art history thing and wondering, well, what would it have been like to have had her as part of the canon that right. I was taught? Like to see somebody kind of like myself and be like, oh, I'm part of a lineage of art making too. I'm part of a lineage of museum worthy work too. How would that change what's happening now? And so in some funny way, so I wrote down this, the book concept came to me right away mm-hmm. and I did a whole outline and then it sort of just sat there for mm-hmm. 2 years. And then right after we found out they passed on the show, I had it was time for me to work on the new book mm-hmm. and I knew this was going to be it. But like suddenly I think Anita the Monte, the character, became so full of so many things because it was not just the basis of biography was Ana Mendieta, but like that sense of feeling of like not being able to break your way into the inside of the circle. Mm-hmm. I was able to bring a lot of personal sentiment to, I guess.
Which is part of what I love about the book, but you also, in an earlier interview, said, well, I had to do an entire rewrite before the world as what we know as Anita.
Yeah.
Because you had not been happy with what you'd put on the page.
No, it was super depressing. Mm-hmm. Like, the college parts were kind of depressing. And, like, and my friends, one of my friends is here, but, like, I remember she read it and was like, I mean, it's very beautifully written. Like, it was like, but you know, like, I remember when she read Olga and she's like, this is going to be a bestseller. And this time, and I was just like, oh, she's like, well, it's just really dark. You know, and like, and my best friend was like, girl, I mean, everything you wrote in here is true, but like, come on. But I actually think the trick was that everything was in third person, including Anita de Monte's character. And then even if you didn't want it to have sadness, there's something about observing somebody that is dead versus them being the person and being in the experience that is inevitably sad. Mm-hmm. Like we're like, oh, I'm reading about the victim of a crime. Like you can't get away from it and the feelings that we bring. Mm-hmm. And it just kept this weight on the words. Mm-hmm. And it just wasn't flying, but it didn't feel like a book Sochi Gonzalez wanted to put in the world because mm-hmm. I felt like, I don't know, I think what I loved about Olga and what I love about this is that everybody has agency and that at the end you feel like, I think they're going to be okay, mm-hmm. right? And like, and I think to me, all of a sudden, well, it was a whole journey because somebody said, a friend of mine was like, well, you should really go and convene with Ana Mendieta's ghost. And she lives behind the American Academy of Rome. And you just need to go. And so I emailed them. And actually, I had a friend from Brown who did work as like in the food. Like she runs the food gardens there. And so she told me who to email. And they were very nonchalant about it. Like they get this email every day. And they're like, May 6th, 7th, and 8th, between 12 and 3, come. And so then I went. And I flew to Rome. And I did this thing. And sure enough, where I was told to go, like I sat for a little while. And then my experience of it was I heard this woman say, like, you can borrow my story, but you have to use my voice. And then she was very, 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 very mouthy about a lot of things. And then I was like, I got it. I've got my thing. And then mm-hmm. I went back to New York and I revised all of her parts into first mm-hmm. person. Mm-hmm. And it was like a totally different book because now, like, well, I'm dead. I was thrown out of a window. Because I was thrown out of a window, not only did he get away with it, but now nobody sees what I was known for. And now I'm just known for being dead. And I am furious about it. And then that sense of like also being furious, you know, I guess I'm not a person that thinks that the world just is contained to what we're experiencing here. And so then it was like, well, now it can open it up. And it's like, well, then how could she get power and how does she lose power? And how could she mess with the real world if she could? And suddenly now this person that was murdered has agency. Mm-hmm. And the end of her story is not the death. And that felt really exciting.
As a reader, too, one of the things I appreciate about your books, and I've said this to you before, is the balance between humor and the dark bits, because I love the dark bits, but you do have to give people a chance to exhale.
Oh, God, yeah.
And I can imagine what this book looked like before we got this iteration.
Yeah.
Thank you for the revisions. Yeah. Thank you. But also, you know, one of the things that I really am been sort of circling around is brown girls and anger.
Yeah.
Because that's a space that makes a lot of people very uncomfortable.
Oh, I know. Right? Yeah.
And so when Raquel sort of has her moments and when Anita has her moments and the world shows up and says, excuse us, we're not really prepared for this little bit of attitude, right? Speaking out of, you know, brown girl has opinion, speaks too much, news at 11.
Yeah.
Right. But seeing that bounce, right? Seeing that bounce on the page. And, you know, part of what you're writing about, obviously, too, is systems, right? And,
totally.
And the things that come up and get in the way. And some of them are predictable. Some of them are not.
Yeah.
Learned helplessness is fascinating.
Oh, I know, right? I know.
It's totally fascinating. And also seeing some of the women who participate in these systems, too. Like, I'm not kidding when I say we were barbarians in the 90s. Like, we really did not know. And then the 80s made us look like we were smart.
Oh, I know. Well, I don't know if I told you this part, but I ordered all of these like women's magazines from the 90s when I was doing research.
You did, but I'm going to ask you to share that story because it was over dinner and there was much laughing.
Yeah. So I was like, you know, it's really hard to remember how you thought even 5 years ago because so much is changing now. And so I ordered all of these like old women's magazines and old hip hop magazines and like old New Yorkers and New York magazines to just kind of get in the zeitgeist of the time. And I texted my like text thread of girlfriends and I was like, we are lucky we survived. I was like it was really just like, I mean, the young people today would like burn effigies at the publishing offices doors. Like it was really like, just, and we were just lapping it up. You know, like it was like one article after another about like, the diet that'll make him find you sexy and like, you know, like suiting. It's an idea. Like, and it's like what are you?
Pantyhose.
Too, you know, pantyhose. There was like an article that was like, are you coming across as too powerful? Mm-hmm. Like it was like all of these like things that were just so.
Remember the hair?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And like, I mean, it was fascinating. It was really, truly fascinating. And then in terms of like, you know, I think it's funny. And one of the reasons why I wanted to certainly set this in the 90s mm-hmm. is I do sometimes think, and this is a similar reason why I had Prieto have his storyline, I do sometimes think that we are harsher on ourselves and don't realize how rapid change has been.
Right.
And like that, you know, Gen X women in particular, like got so many crazy mixed messages. And so like sometimes it's like, you know, it takes a second to hear what's happening now and like, and have it compute, you know, like, I think like,
what
like,
was that Diane Keaton movie about the baby in Vermont and the
baby
food empire?
Oh, I love that movie. I love that movie. It's called Baby Boom.
Okay, thank you.
And then she starts, like, she can't, like, lest she just do nothing after she retires from, like, her advertising career, she decides that she's gonna, it's, like, called, like, Healthy Baby or something. Vermont Baby. It was Vermont Baby. I've seen that movie so many times, it's, like, embarrassing. It's amazing, yeah. No, but I made actually a young friend of mine who's like 24, 25 watch it this summer.
And
she thought it was the most fabulous like archival thing about like a past time.
I was looking like, for that archival word. Yeah. I was like, what did the 20-something think about this movie? But really, I mean, we had no idea. And part of Raquel's struggle, and Raquel is our girl.
I mean,
we're going to come back to Anita, but I want to ground us in Raquel for a second. Because she feels very, very of the moment, right, as this kid trying to figure out what it means to have access. And she doesn't have the language that we have, right? She does not, privilege is not a word that exists for her.
No.
She just knows a really cute boy likes her.
Yeah.
And stuff happens for her because the cute boy likes her. And I have feelings about him. I may have some rude notes in my galley. And his mama. Mm.
Oh, I know. His mom is like really actually terrible.
She's entertaining, but I'm glad she's not in my orbit outside of the book.
No, I know. Well, her boyfriend, you know, at this part, I don't know that I've actually talked about much, but the boyfriend character for Raquel, mm-hmm. Nick, I called the hottest guy in my class, or the guy who, in my opinion, was the hottest guy mm-hmm. in my class at Brown, and was like, I want to talk to you about what it was like being so hot. like at that
And he
age.
Answered you though,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, no, he answered me. But then like in the beginning he was home. Like it was still kind of a little, oh, it was Omicrommy, you know, so like people were kind of back to semi-isolated. And so he was home and he was like, I don't really think much happened differently for me just because of my looks. And his wife is in the background. She's like, get out of here. She's like, literally get out of here if this is how you're going to talk. And she's like, go take a walk for the dog. You know, like it was she's like, everything happens to you because you're good looking. Like it was like hilarious. So no, but like I think it was really interesting for me to remember stories about him that women had told me and for his recollection of it to be so like faded and shaky. It was just like, well, I sort of thought this happened. And then it made me realize how like just fumbling in the dark kind of like young people in general sometimes, but like young men, I think in particular, like I'm trying some things out. Like, I don't know.
Our brains don't finish cooking until we're
25.
They're
not cooked. Exactly. It's like uncooked brains and opportunity and trying things out. And like, and talking to him, like, I know he's frustrating to readers, like the boyfriend, but I think
I wouldn't describe him as frustrating. No,
yeah.
I really wouldn't. I was just like, okay, dude.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Bring it.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a lot of, I genuinely wasn't frustrated. It's just,
good. Okay.
I was frustrated with Raquel.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
That's,
yeah.
I mean, and there were a couple of times where I was like, don't open that door. Don't open that. Yes, I'm talking about a fictional character, like she's sitting next to me. But there were more than a couple of moments where I was like, oh, sweetie, okay, you're 20.
Yeah,
respectfully,
right.
You're 20. Okay.
Oh, I know.
And
oh,
I,
my gosh.
And for story purposes, very good. For, you know, adult woman of a certain age going, oh, okay. Okay.
And then, you know, it's so funny because, like, the big thing, to go back to that earlier point, was, like, Raquel, part of why she's flying so blind, too, is, like, her mom actually, you know, her mom was inspired by my grandmother, who was, like, so over the idea of me going to, she hated the, like, she's like, why are you at that snobby place? Like, she hated it. And Raquel's mom has a similar, like, ambivalent, suspicious attitude about the entire endeavor. But she never even tells her, really, that she's in the relationship until, like, they're forced into it. And so, like, there's no chance to even reap wisdom. Like, you know, like, this idea of you can't understand it is this own form of sort of funny snobbery, right? Like, it's like, and I think that I wanted her to kind of also be a little bit undone by her own snobbery.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you buy into the thing you don't know, right? You think it's actually better than the thing that you know cold.
Of course.
And as much as Raquel wants to be who she is and her, you know, rock star self, essentially, she really does want what she sees Nick and his family having. And watching her navigate that space.
Yeah.
Those were the moments where I was like, oh, just throw an elbow, just throw an elbow, just throw an elbow. And of course, she's not that person, so she's not going to do that. But there's a lot that you cover that also, had we been in an era of cell phones and social media, would not have been possible.
No, I know, right?
Like the serendipity and the discovery and the everyone trying to get to that point that they think they need so desperately. It all could have changed with a really bad tweet.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, yeah.
And so the idea that I was really excited when I realized that all of this was set pre-cell phone. And there were a couple of emails, which all of us were figuring out how email worked anyway.
Oh, we sent letters. Like, we just sent letters.
I did.
Email.
I was an inveterate letter. Remember those blue airmail letters where you covered like every possible squishing?
Yeah. I still have printouts of like super long emails that I got when I was doing study abroad. Like, it was like, well, like they were like camp letters, but just over email.
What about the postcards from people you don't? I was going through, I was cleaning out stuff, and I was like, I don't even know who these people are.
Oh, I know.
Are
who
anymore.
Are you? I know.
Wild to me. It's completely wild. And I mean, I had a perfectly good time at college, and I stay in touch with the people I want to stay in touch with, but it was also sort of a moment.
Yeah.
And then you meet people who are like, and I go to every single reunion, and I'm like, that's nice. That's great. Have a good time. Rock on. I just, you know, I do think Raquel evolves and ends up okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, Nick, he's probably married, whatever, it's fine. But Anita's story, which obviously everything comes together at the end. I'm not spoiling it for you. But Anita sort of runs on a parallel track. She's got a husband who's jealous of her in a way, in a different way.
Yeah.
It's based, as you said, on a real person.
Yeah.
Some of the details. And that person's family had some things to say in the New York Times recently.
Oh, I know. Gosh. Yeah.
And I sort of do want to talk that out with you a little bit.
Yeah.
Only because part of me thinks, well, you're a public person, right? You've become an artist. People own your work. You're, you know, who you are. But also, she does have family. And how do you navigate that space? I mean, yeah, you had the great experience with the ghost, which I love that story. But, you know, what if this happened to you in 50 years?
It is what it is. If it's a public story, it is what it is. Like, I mean, I have an estate because I create IP.
Yep.
And when the people that knew me well, as my peers, pass on, my goddaughter, who's 5 now, that I'm an adult making most of this stuff, will probably be in charge. And she'll have feelings that are more hers than mine.
Yep.
And I'm in the public domain. And so I sort of have to, like, that, you know, I think even I just did the PBS NewsHour, and they showed, actually, the New York Magazine cover story about, like, so this was very much a public story.
Oh, and completely. It was all over the tabloids. I mean,
yeah.
You can go into the Times Wayback Machine, and there's the actual clip. And it's literally, like, 2 inches long, and it just says, artist dies.
Yeah, yeah. And like, and then, like, later he's acquitted.
Right.
Like, and there's this piece about him being acquitted. But I think what I think gets lost in that is that more people who did not know who she is have discovered her because of the book.
Right.
And then they will encounter not just her story, they'll encounter her about her work. They already know her story, so they can encounter her work as her work. And I think that that is an opportunity that maybe is hard to appreciate in the moment. And I think the other part is that the reason I wrote it as fiction was, which was not given any space in the Times, was like, Carl Andrew died like 5 minutes ago. Like, if I were to write about this for The Atlantic, where I work, I would have to put 900 caveats.
Right.
Because there was a mistrial and this and that, and you can't, like, I, in fiction, can have a character who's thrown out of a window, narrate being thrown out of a window.
And turn into a bat.
And turn into a bat. And there is no, and have an afterlife, and have agency.
Right.
And there is a way to empower that story beyond it just being a true crime story. And that, to me, was an intention of empowerment and an intention to take it beyond the end being what the end was.
But, I mean, isn't that the point of the novel, too, is to show interiority?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what the art is.
What I would say is, like, I don't think Anna Mendieta would ask for permission to create art that she was inspired by, even if it was. She was inspired by tons of art.
Right.
You know, like, so much of what she was inspired by ancient art. She was inspired by, you know, more contemporary art. But, like, I think that when something's in the public domain, as long as the intention there, my intention was obviously clearly pro-narrative that way. And I think I just had to make my art, you know. I think I couldn't. Once you start to get into a negotiation, like, I think, you know, it's like, well, yes, as long as you don't. Like, I think you have to just kind of go forth and trust your instincts and know that it's fiction at the end of the day.
One of the details that you did take from her life, this idea that she was brought to the States.
Well, that I had to keep.
Right.
Yes.
And that's, can we go there for a second?
Yes.
Because I think this is huge.
It's so funny.
This
I thought so much about if I had to keep that or not.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
And then what happened was I was in Iowa.
Right.
This also wasn't brought up in that Times article. I was in Iowa as a graduate student. Okay. Like, so I'd known about Anna Mendieta. And then at 20 years after, I went to my 20th college reunion and then I started graduate school that summer. And suddenly I'm in Iowa and the only thing I can think about, the only thing I knew about the University of Iowa before I heard about the Iowa Writers' Workshop was Anna Mendieta had gone there.
Right.
And that she'd been sent to Iowa on Peter Pan.
Sorry, would you explain
Peter Pan? Yes, Peter
Pan, I know some people
was, after the Cuban Revolution, was an unusual collaborative effort between the CIA and the Catholic Church to get Cuban children out of Cuba, lest they be sent to the Soviet Union, which there was no real evidence was going to happen, but there was a Red Scare. And so they convinced all these Cuban families that were sort of on the cusp of being on the outs with Castro to send their kids to America. But what, and that eventually they'd get reunited. But so eventually, like in Anna Mendieta's case, was like, I don't know, 10, 12, 15 years. Like, so, like, she basically was then sent to a foster home and then an orphanage in Iowa. And when I got to Iowa and I had to do a teaching semester and, like, and I'm teaching kids and I had, like, two Latino kids in my class, and I just could not stop thinking about this 12-year-old kid who doesn't speak the language in this freezing Iowa. Mm-hmm. And I'd been to Cuba before, and I was like, oh my God. And then I would walk by the river mm-hmm. on my way to the workshop, and mm-hmm. I would think about her burying herself in the banks of the Iowa River as part of her art. And even when I was like, maybe I keep it, maybe I don't need to keep it. And then I went to Cuba again to go and experience it. And when I smelled the soil in Cuba and I thought about what she had been doing in America and how much her art changed after that trip, I was like, the only reason why she was such a badass in her time, despite mm-hmm. there being permission for somebody to be like this, was because she was always like, I didn't even ask to be here. Like, you're lucky I'm here. Like, she didn't have this kind of apologetic, like, oh, I'm so happy that my parents brought me here and we had a chance for a better life. She was like, no, this place is kind of whack. And, like, you're kind of lucky that I'm here. And I was made to clean houses by these foster families. And I was stuck in this orphanage. And everybody's made fun of me my whole life because of the way that I talk and blah, blah, blah. Like, and so she was like, so now I'm going to make art and I'm going to tell you about yourselves and about me. And I think that she had that sense of confidence because she wasn't like the typical sort of like, I'm seeking a better life. Like, it was like, where did you send me? And I felt that I had to keep that because mm-hmm. that sort of sense of verve, like, and mm-hmm. like, you know, Raquel is born in America. Like, you know, she's like, who knows how many generations back and forth or in New York she is from Puerto Rico. And like, and the idea that she's like, thank you, Professor Temple. You know, like, she's been so conditioned to just be so grateful for being there. And that I needed to have the spirit, the Anita character. And I felt that it was that biographical childhood mm-hmm. that gave her that idea of that sense of biggerness than this.
Like, right. And if you look at the stories of women artists in America, right, like, I'm just sort of thinking of Ninth Street Women, you know,
the
biography. Ambition was considered a little, you know, déclassé.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And so reading her chapters and just seeing really unbridled ambition for someone in her time period, right? Like, that's like, we're going back to the 80s where it was just not ladylike to be ambitious. And it was really refreshing, but you could also see how she would unbalance her husband a little bit.
Yeah.
Where he's a dude not quite used to that kind of
totally
situation and context.
And that he's not surrounded, like, in his social circle with right. other partners that right. are like that. But I will also say, you know, sometimes my friends will tease me that I am too confident. But, like, I think that I will say this, like, I think part of it is she had to do so much for herself and right. I had to do so much for myself.
Yeah.
And I think when you do a lot of things for yourself, like, there's a certain amount of, like, I think Raquel, as she gets older, will become increasingly confident when she realizes how much she's figured out. And I think, like, to Anita, she's like, I earned my spot here. Mm-hmm. Like, and I think to him, he's both attracted to that, like, right? And, like, as often happens sometimes, like, initially that's really attractive. And then it's like living with it is like, why couldn't you be more like so-and-so's wife?
Right. Which brings us to professional jealousy, which, again,
yes.
we're used to seeing, like, women pitted against women or men pitted against women and artist against artist kind of thing. And then what happens when it's in your living room
yeah.
and it's your spouse?
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
That's a whole different world.
Well, and the other thing is Jack has, like, a work wife, right? Mm-hmm. Like, Jack has his art dealer who's kind of his work wife.
Oh, and kind of? No,
I mean,
definitely.
She's his work wife. She's his work wife. And so she not only looms over Anita as, like, this ideal prototype
Dude,
of
that
a
scene
woman.
In the bathroom, that oh. scene in the bathroom, I'm just going to, if you have not yet read the scene, okay, you know what I'm talking about. That scene in the bathroom, it's like, oh.
But, you know, she's like, and she's his little messenger and his confidant, and she's all these things, but she's also all the things that is dominant in that world. You know, she'd gone to the finishing school. Like, she'd gone to all the right, like, she'd gone to all the right preparatory schools and the finishing school. You know, she's like, she's a woman in a man's world, but she also was trained into how to be, like, a woman around men.
But also that shift in generation between
yes.
the art dealer and Nick's mother.
Oh, totally.
Into Raquel.
Yeah.
And even Anita to a certain extent, because Anita's not the same generation.
No, no, she's
as
not.
Mama
no.
Fitzsimmons and
yeah.
Tilly the art dealer.
No.
And even those sort of, you know, 5-10 year shifts, right, which are seismic.
And that's, again, like, I am so happy you brought that up because it's part mm. of why it was fun and important to me to create those characters, mm-hmm. To just show how much womanhood is evolving.
Right.
Like, from, you know, and it's not into now, but, like, as we think now about, well, as we engage with each other, how we just are shaped slightly differently, mm-hmm. with slightly different perspectives about how we're meant to be, and that some of the conflict is absolutely generational, right? Like, and I think that was actually really fun, mm-hmm. to write and fun to think through, but also fun to kind of watch Raquel sort of liberate her, because she's sort of at a crossroads. And I, mm-hmm. definitely think, like, when I go to reunions, there's definitely, like, I always tell people that at our, like, it was totally you were not judged if you were like, I'm going to probably go and work at, like, Goldman or, like, at Bain for a couple of years and let's see who I meet. Like, it was, like, totally, like, not, like, there was, like, it was a path to an end. And that was, like, I think we're, like,
I think that was also
that.
A moment in time, too.
Totally.
I mean, there were plenty of, I remember, classmates who sort of did a similar thing and then dropped out and basically got married and had lots of,
yeah.
children. And great. If,
yeah.
you want to do that, that's your thing. That's great. But the idea that there was this sort of monolithic expectation that because we were women, we wanted a certain thing.
That's right.
And some of us are standing around scratching our heads going, I don't actually think I want that. Thank you very much. But okay. It was wild.
It was wild.
Just really wild. And I also say this as a person who's, you know, the legacy of several old white men at my college. And I show up on the door and they're like, oh, hi. Had a perfectly good time.
Oh my gosh,
I mean,
that's really, that's
had a
great.
Perfectly,
yeah.
perfectly good time. But at the same time, I'm like, you know, I'm fully aware,
yeah.
that it didn't hurt to have three names that I could, you know, scribble in the box.
Oh, totally.
When I mailed a paper application.
Totally. Well, you know, there was an alternate ending that, mm-hmm. was not as good, but it was satisfying in a much more sort of, right. pedestrian way. But where it ends with her graduation and her taking her mother to campus dance.
Yeah.
And the idea being is, like, it wasn't completely lost. Like, that time with Nick wasn't completely lost. She did get a sense of ownership of the place that, mm-hmm. his familiarity helped bestow on her, and his sense of, like, taking up space, like, sort of helped.
Well,
help
you
her.
Also use shrink really, you use it a bunch of times early in the book where,
yeah.
it's Anita talking about not shrinking. It's Raquel talking about shrinking.
Yeah.
And I think that's such a great metaphor, because I do think there are times where, as women, we are taught to step back because that's the polite thing to do, or someone gets very uncomfortable because we refuse to step back. But I liked the metaphor that you chose. I just thought, oh, yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
It's like pulling yourself in and just kind of doing that thing with your body. Where,
well, when we first meet Raquel, she's at office hours with her thesis advisor. And I loved that character, by the way.
He's, like, very well-intentioned.
I also, he's in the midst of getting a divorce, you figure out, like, pretty early on. And she's just like, oh, my God, he's, like, the sad divorced guy. And just, like, you know, like, the way that, like, you perceive age at 20 is just so, like, melodramatic. You know, like, it's like, oh, that's horrible. Like, you know, but it starts out and he thinks she had told him that her mom had worked at the cafeteria at the Met, and she comes to tell him how she got this fellowship, and he thinks he's being charming, and he's like, a long way from serving sandwiches at the Met, right? And, oh, yeah. she's like, she thought she was, she walked in, she's like so proud of herself, and then she suddenly is like, like, and she just feels so small, and partly because she hasn't learned to kind of code switch herself. Like, she hasn't fully, like, transitioned into, like, she's like her first instinct is she's like, she wants to be like, what the heck, you know, like, and, like, she's like, you don't do that here, you don't do that at Brown. And so she hasn't learned how to, like, do the jargon and the, like, actually, no, you know, like, blah, blah, blah.
That's also learning, like, how to manipulate a system.
100%.
You know, I mean, code switching, manipulating systems,
yeah.
whatever we want to
call it. Whatever
we
want to call it.
It's navigating space.
Yeah.
And if you aren't shown how to navigate the space,
yeah,
of course you're not going to know. I did have moments with Raquel, though, where I was like, stop caring what other people think. Sweetie, your life will be better if you just stop caring what other people think. She's 20. I'm yelling at a 20-year-old, a fictional 20-year-old. But yeah, everything comes together. I will say everything comes together because you are a problem solver. You have always been a problem solver. One of the things I love about Sochi's story is, you know, at 40, she's like, you know, I'm tired of being a wedding planner. I'm really tired of this. I'm going to go get my MFA. And I love this part of the story because, as you said before, you took yourself to Iowa.
Yeah.
Which is a fabulous program. I mean, Justin Torres, Ianna Mathis, Brandon Taylor. I mean, lots of really fabulous writers that I love have come out of Iowa, including this one. But you took yourself from all of this to Iowa. Now, granted, you had the novel sold. Like, it's not like you were just ripping out all of the bits and
I sold
moving.
It there. So I did okay. rip all right. out the
okay.
bits.
Okay,
but,
sorry.
But, you know, it felt, I had a friend who was very wise.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, when I started freaking out about my rent-stabilized apartment with good reason, she was like, it's going to take you twice as long to do this a different way. Mm-hmm. And she was so right. She was so mm-hmm. right. I mean, just the time. Like, if I was doing an MFA here, I would have still been working a full-time job, yeah. trying to, like just the time to write was a gift. And so, you know, it was a really good gamble, like, that kind of paid off, really. But I think also, to that point of time, you know, I just was in Iowa City, and I saw a couple of my classmates who've stayed, and they were like, one of them was like, if I had the time again, the way I would use that differently. Like, just in 3 years, like, mm-hmm. from being the difference between experiencing two academic years at 25 to 28, let's say,
yeah, yeah.
whereas I got there at 42, and I was like, it's actually, like, I think I had it down to the weeks. I was like, it's like 26 weeks, mm-hmm. like, for one each year, you know, like, and I'm yeah. like, how are you going to use this time where you don't have to have, like, a real job? Like, and so it was a risk, but I think it was, like, this exciting chance to get off the hamster wheel of adulting, and I did it. And now you're
well, and you made the most of it. But midlife career change.
Yeah.
Like, you've done it. You not just the going to school, but there were some other changes too.
Oh, yeah.
And whatnot. Clearly it was worth it for you.
Yeah.
But a stranger walks up to you and says, well, what do you tell them?
I mean, what I've told people in general is mm-hmm. like, you have to commit to one small change towards the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I didn't just like decide to like, I applied to like a writing program. So then I committed every day to waking up and writing the essay to apply to the program. Mm-hmm. And then when I got into the program, I was like, well, let me just make sure that it's perfect by the time I get there. And then I started a writing group and we would meet every month. And so like I sort of worked in a dedication to doing the thing
mm-hmm.
little by little to the mm-hmm. point that it just kept getting bigger and bigger. And so by the time I got into Iowa, I had the idea for the book. And then I was like, I was religious about it. I mean, like, I would get up at 5 and I'd write till 7 and then on the weekends, and this was my real thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it started with, let me just work on this essay and I'll apply to this thing, because then I had a deadline, so I knew I'd keep going.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I'm like, yeah. oh, if I know I'll keep going. So I think I always say to people that are curious about doing something or writing in particular, but like find a thing to apply to, because even if you don't get it in, like, it's about giving yourself the discipline of a deadline. Mm-hmm. And then you believe in yourself and you develop confidence as you go, right?
Mm-hmm,
like,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, even with career changes, it's like, who do you know? Like, just call people for informational interviews, commit to doing one a week. Like, it's annoying, weird advice, but it's the thinking, it's if you don't start anything, like, then it is impossible.
You mean it's the problem solving
It's
advice.
The problem solving. It's the wedding planner. It's the wedding planner in me, and I'll never stop. Yeah.
That's okay.
I have to keep solving problems.
Totally admit that we bonded over cloth napkins
yeah.
the first time we spoke. I was just like, you know, cheap cloth napkins, this sounds like a minor thing, but it's one of those details where you're like, if people stand up and they're covered in lint,
yeah,
it's not fun.
It's not fun.
You still have Brooklyn Everywhere, your column with The Atlantic,
yes.
which got you a nod as a Pulitzer finalist, yes, for commentary.
Yes.
Okay, you're still doing that.
Yes, yes. Okay. I'm working on something for the magazine right now, so okay. I haven't published in a little bit, but yeah.
Okay, so you're finishing up the tour, obviously, for Anita.
Yes.
You working on anything else?
I am.
That you can talk about?
Yeah, no, I can. I'm excited. This summer, I'm going to just go and, you know, kind of hole away and mm-hmm. write. And I'm working on my third book, which is like a, it's kind of a gender swapped retelling of The Great Gatsby set in Fort Greene before the fiscal crisis, like in the summer of the Democratic primary.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it's kind of, I see it as a trilogy, because like there's characters, most of them minor, one of them less minor, that are from both of the other two books.
Oh, this is good. This is very good.
So like it sort of closes a circle between the other two books in some way. So Mateo's back, for people who know Mateo, which is exciting. Yeah.
Okay, so we can do this again, is what you're saying. We've done this for every book so far.
I know.
And obviously, we have a very good time doing it. Thank you, New York, for joining us. This is Poured Over. And Sochi Gonzalez, I'm Miwa Messer. Thank you again for joining
us. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Poured Over is a Barnes & Noble production. To help other readers find us, please rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts.